Broad markets have largely shrugged off the impact of the Delta variant as it spreads, but we are potentially seeing some pockets of exposure in parts of the economy. Southwest Airlines, for example, said that the surge that we have seen in cases tied to Delta is hurting its bookings and is going to make it harder for the airline to make a profit in this current quarter. Helane Becker is with us now, Cowen senior analyst who covers the airlines. Helane, it's good to see you. And it has been interesting how, by and large, we haven't seen market participants too concerned about this, but this really brings home that there are some risks for this. How we haven't seen the other airlines make these comments, but how widespread do you think these issues could be?
Bring me on. I appreciate the time. I think that everybody's going to update guidance at some point. I think the question is how much is related to the Delta variant causing a decline in close-in bookings, and how much of the deceleration in forward bookings is caused by normal seasonal weakness. So you have two things at play here. Normally in August, especially mid to late August, you would see a decline in forward bookings as people start to return from vacations, go back to school. Here you have the added pressure, I guess, of returning to office. So you have all of that combined at a time when the Delta variant obviously seems to be running rampant in locations where you don't have a lot of people who are vaccinated, and that's causing people to rethink their close-in plans. And I think that's what Southwest was saying this morning. The other thing too, they didn't say this specifically, but I've talked to all the airlines this week, and I am hearing last week there was a lot of bad weather in the U.S. I wasn't in the U.S. last week, but there was a lot of bad weather from what I could tell, and that caused a lot of flight cancellations. And so you have some decline in August related to the fact that airlines had to either do refunds or move crew members around who got caught out because of thunderstorms and they were in the wrong spot. And then you had, for a consumer perspective, giving people refunds, which I mentioned, and then you had to give them hotel vouchers or meal vouchers or rebooking and so on. So I think there's like three things going on here, and that's what you're seeing.
Yeah, and you know, Helane, we're kind of going around the short-term potential, you know, quarter-on-quarter margin impacts, all that stuff that, you know, you analysts spend a lot of time thinking about. But ultimately, I look at the market today, right, and Southwest shares are off 1/10. American shares are actually up about 1%. And it seems like investors have decided that the story for the airlines is they're going to make it through and we'll figure out what the new normal is in a year or two. Is that kind of the sense you get from talking to both the airlines and also to your clients?
Yeah, to the investors, I think everybody's decided to try to power through this, right? We've heard from various people who are smarter than me with the healthcare issues that are basically saying this may be a short-lived variant and then we're through it and maybe we go into the fall and we're done. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure that part of it out. But yeah, Miles, I think that one of the things we're definitely seeing is people are tired of hearing about it. They want to get out and about. You see that with the strength of bookings and travel this summer. And I think people are, and I think the airline industry in general also is just ready to get on with whatever our next normal is. The industry has plenty of liquidity. The government made sure of that. The airlines have pretty good, I mean, the balance sheets have deteriorated a lot. You and I have talked about that. But that said, the airlines have done a really good job of trying to raise fares and trying to just pay down debt and get back to a position. And it will take a couple of years, to your point, before we get there. But I think that the demand will remain robust. People want to go, and you're seeing it in full load factors. I think Southwest said this morning that load factor was what, mid-80s, like 85-87%. I mean, those are not insignificant numbers, right? And if you've flown at all, or any of your viewers have flown at all, they've seen full planes. So and long lines at airports. So yeah, I think we're just going to power through and just hope for the best on the other side of this.
Helane, do you think the fact that United is now going to be mandating vaccinations for its staff, is that going to give it a competitive advantage?
I think so. I think yes. Yeah, I was really impressed with that decision. And then Hawaiian Airlines and Frontier Airlines both said that they would mandate vaccines for staff as well. I know Delta said that they would not mandate vaccines for staff, but all new hires had to be vaccinated. I think others will probably follow if this is going to be an industry standard. But I mean, not to get political, I think having people vaccinated is an advantage.
And then
Yeah,
Helene,
it
just
would seem
finally,
to be. Sorry, go ahead.
yeah, oh, sorry, Julie. And Helene, just finally, we're getting through the summer season here, and Southwest flagging that Labor Day still looks strong. When is it time for you guys to start thinking about what the holiday season might look like for some of these airlines, and how that might shake out, and if that's a time to bring more crews and more planes back online, or if people like this, and 87% indeed was the load factor for Southwest in July, or if the airlines are happy keeping that number high, and maybe thinking about turning a couple gears on fares.
Yeah, I'd love to see them turn gears on fares, right? I'd like to see them keep capacity where it is and raise fares. That would be a good thing from the analyst perspective, maybe not from my personal pocketbook perspective. But I think that for the holidays, especially if the Delta variant kind of burns itself out, you're going to see huge demand. And people who may not have had the opportunity to travel this summer will want to travel over the holidays. You always see, not everybody goes home for Thanksgiving, but they always go home for Christmas and New Year's. And I think that what you're going to see, it's too early, right? August is just too early. But that said, the airlines are definitely in hiring mode. Everybody has said in the last 4 or 5 weeks that they're hiring more pilots, they're hiring flight attendants, or looking for ground staff. So that's going to continue right through the holidays and into 2022, because this is not going to be with us forever. I mean, we're at a year and a half. How can this, possibly stay forever? And that, although, I've been wrong before. Then when you go into the holiday season, they will bring back additional aircraft. They're doing that. You see the MAX being delivered to United and American. Delta announced an aircraft order 2 weeks ago. So the capacity is coming back on stream. They're going to have to hire to fill those positions. And then they're going to have to offer fares that are competitive with others out there that attract p passengers to the product. So yeah, all around, I think. I mean, I guess what I am saying really badly is that I never expected the recovery to be linear. We always expected it to be choppy. But I don't think I expected, like, I don't know, what wave are we in? Like fourth, fifth, sixth? I never expected all these different waves of COVID. I kind of expected it, us to flatten the curve and kind of move on with our lives. And that's certainly not what's occurred.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're all trying to figure this out. And our predictive ability is not that it was ever great as human beings, but it's certainly not been helped by all of this. Helane Becker, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you. Thanks for your perspective on this, Helane Becker of Cowen. Have a
Thanks.
great day, Helane. We'll talk to you soon.
But let's stay on the markets here and talk a bit about the setup for the equity markets, how to think about fixed income at this point, and sort of just what the next year or so for investments could look like. Noah Weisberger joins us now, Managing Director of PGIM's Institutional Advisor and Solutions Group. Noah, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. Let's start with what's happened in the Treasury market over the last week. We've seen the 10-year kind of back up about 20 basis points. And we've just seen a lot of volatility in that part of the Treasury market. How are you thinking about what that means? What kind of challenges that presents for portfolio managers, and where ultimately you think, rates might find a little bit more of a steady footing?
Thanks so much for having me this morning. Great, great questions all. And our perspective is really on the interaction between the fixed income market and the equity market, and how those two markets interact with each other. And then, of course, what that means for portfolios. And I think you hit it right on that, the nail right on the head when you talked about rate market volatility. We think that's one of the more important factors that drive the correlation between stock returns and bond returns. And as that uncertainty about rates themselves, and my interpretation of that would be a little bit more uncertainty about rate setting policy, as that ticks higher, there's a greater likelihood that we would see a shift from the prevailing regime of negative stock bond correlation to a regime where we might see positive stock bond correlation. That's really what we're focused on, these long regimes that last decades and decades. We've been through about 20 years of negative stock and bond correlation. And what would be the signals that would point us to start thinking that stock bond correlation may shift? And that's what we're focused on here.
So, no, it's Julie here. So what are some of those signals? And are you seeing any of them already? Do investors need to start to position, or is it too early to say that yet?
Look, this is a difficult call. And in part, it's difficult because as we look back at the post-war record in the U.S., there have been three long regimes, right? So we're not talking about the daily wiggles or the monthly wiggles in the correlation between stock and bond returns. We're talking about, are they negatively correlated, in which case bonds are a natural hedge to risky assets in the portfolio, or are they positively correlated, where the volatility of the portfolio is actually exacerbated by the assets, that they their interaction. And so we've only gotten two or three turning points, regime changes in the last 70 years. So to try to predict or forecast when those are coming is pretty difficult. That said, we think there's some linkages to the policy setting environment. Positive stock bond correlation, which would be a new regime for us relative to where we've been for the last 20 years, would probably be symptomatic of monetary policy that's more discretionary than we're used to, and fiscal policy that's viewed as less sustainable, perhaps, than we're used to. And those are kind of the broad themes that we're tracking. And we think that then relates to some more statistical macro-driven factors that can then be kind of more reliably related statistically to stock bond correlation itself. But we think this is largely a conversation about policy.
So, I mean, no, ultimately, it kind of sounds like we're just talking or going towards the question of what is the 60-40 portfolio still alive? Is that still the baseline way to maybe think about, you know, constructing something? And I guess, are you essentially having conversations with clients who don't want to have a certain level of exposure to, let's say, equities, but you're saying, look, our work is telling us that you might need to tolerate that if you are to meet, you know, some kind of return target? Is that kind of the framework here?
That's exactly right. And I think it's a little bit less about the 60-40 portfolio per se, but about any a multi-asset portfolio. You know, anytime you start to mix assets, and we've looked narrowly at the big benchmarks at you know, U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds, anytime you mix assets, that correlation component is really, really important. And so basically, you know, to distill it in its most stark terms, if you have a return target that you need to meet as a CIO or pension plan, and you have a risk budget that you want to satisfy, that trade-off gets much more tricky if you can't rely on negative correlation. And so if correlation shifts from negative to positive, either you have to lower your allocation to risky assets from whatever level it is, right? This is not just about 60-40, but any stock allocation would have to come down to maintain risk tolerance. Alternatively, if you have to meet a return target, you'd have to accept a higher volatility. You don't have that natural hedge in the portfolio. And so that's why we're focused on this this component of portfolio construction. It's really important for CIOs, for asset allocators, for risk managers to get their heads around what a change might mean.
And as you say, it comes down to policy in a lot of ways. And the Fed has worked to make policy very transparent and very predictable. Do you think that they have succeeded?
Up until now, I think the evidence is pretty clear that they have. And you know, we've looked at this in a lot of different quantitative ways. And I think the contrast that people have in mind, and I think it's the right contrast, would be to the, you know, the mid-60s through the mid-1990s. Where you first saw monetary policy operating much, much more loosely than an algorithm might suggest, and the second half of that period much more tightly. And so a lot of people divide the 60s, 70s, 80s into pre-Volcker and post-Volcker. Our view is that pre and post-Volcker, monetary policy was discretionary. It allowed too much inflation in, and then it had to squeeze a lot of that inflation out. But since then, we've had a really rules-based policy. You know, the zero lower bound has made things a little bit more difficult. The Fed's had to rely on communication. The addition of a press conference has been very helpful. The projections have all been ways that they've tried to be as transparent as possible. That's all what we've experienced up until now. And I think what the risks that we're highlighting is as the Fed starts to talk about long-term average inflation targeting, and even more potentially frightening or a harbinger of times past, would be as debt levels rise in the U.S. There's a monetary and fiscal policy component here. as debt levels rise in the U.S., arguments could be made for greater coordination of policy. And I say that very hesitatingly and certainly not in an explicit way in the U.S., but that would be another kind of worst of all worlds should that start to become a market risk. And again, I would say it's not just monetary policy. It's not just fiscal policy. It's the interaction of the two and the strategic interactions of the two.
And, you know, Noah, we're having a, I think, a very interesting high-level conversation, but we look on the ground last 24 hours reporting around, will Jay Powell be renamed Fed chair? I mean, does the person at the top of the Fed, as you think about this new framework, how much could that shift some of what we're discussing here? Or is it, or has there been enough of a regime change in the Board of Governors that whoever is leading the Fed likely won't reshape sort of this new framework they've embarked on?
Look, as an outsider, it's hard to imagine real regime change at the Fed. I mean, it's such a strong institution. It's such a bedrock of our financial system. And so you'd almost think it's next man up or next person up kind of mentality, where the next person who occupies the chair will continue to do what Bernanke, Yellen, Greenspan, Powell have all seeked to do in terms of their ability to communicate with markets and deliver rules-based, if you will, policy and independent policy. But along the margins, we've seen conversations that, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when I first started out as a watching markets, I wouldn't have imagined happening. You know, talking about an inflation target, a long-term average inflation target, no one really is quite sure what that might mean. And again, I think the pressure may come outside as debt to GDP or deficits extend. The incentives certainly are there. Now, we're not predicting anything like regime change at all. We're just highlighting that as those question marks show up, we may see a concrete shift in the way the markets behave. But ultimately, I think the institutions are quite strong, as you suggest.
All right. Great conversation. Noah Weisberger, Managing Director of PGIM's Institutional Advisor and Solutions Group. Noah, appreciate the time this morning.
In our real estate report today, we are talking about the move out of major cities. We saw that trend accelerated by the pandemic, and a new report out from CoreLogic points to continued exits out of cities like New York. Let's bring in Selma Hepp. She is CoreLogic's Deputy Chief Economist. And Selma, it's good to talk to you today. You know, we have talked about this over the last 18 months, but the numbers in your study are more backwards looking. We're talking about 2020, 8 months into this year. To what extent are we continuing to see the pace of the exits remain as they were in 2020? Or are we starting to see a bit of a slowdown now that people are slowly going back into the office?
Right. Well, thanks first for having me. What our report shows is that the number of people that were leaving in comparison to people coming into New York in 2020 increased. And I do believe in 2021 that number has come down. So even in 2019, for every one person coming in, there were four applicants applying outside the metro area. That number increased to 6 to 1. And I do believe now in 2021, as the economy is opening up and companies are looking for people to come back into the offices, particularly large metropolitan areas, there will be more people coming in, so that ratio will come down again.
You also got, I mean, the big boost to savings in the pandemic. So maybe more people just have more to spend on homes right now, which is why we've seen home prices go up a bit. But it does seem like you still have top of mind for you know, house seekers out there looking at areas that have lower tax rates. I mean, is that still kind of the trend that you're seeing play out?
Right. So that was one of the interesting results of our report, is that out of the top 15 metro areas, with people coming in, 10 of them were in locations that had no income taxes. So those were areas in Florida, in Arizona, Nevada. So people were definitely looking to save, given the economic uncertainty. I do think that trend may continue, because we will have, you know, still a lot of people being able to work from home. And there may be that reshuffling of some of the baby boomers who didn't sell during the pandemic, but they're selling now and moving to these areas.
Having said that, it's interesting to see the city that's at the top of the list here in terms of inbound traffic. And you're talking about Riverside, yeah, California, which is about, right, what, 70 minutes outside of LA? I mean, what does that say about the desire to see, be within proximity of these major hubs, even if they can't necessarily afford the homes in that area. What are you seeing in terms of that geographically? Is it different on the West Coast versus the East Coast?
No, actually, I think it's quite similar. You know, people are trying to remain close to their work locations, close to the amenities that urban areas, large urban areas, afford to them. But then when you look at the affordability between the two areas and Riverside specifically here, the cost of housing is half of what it is in Los Angeles or neighboring San Diego. So you save about half of your income on housing, and you're still able to go to your work location, whether that be 2 or 3 days a week, and access the other urban amenities that there are.
Yeah, we talk about kind of a potential catalyst to maybe trigger a slowdown in the appreciation in home prices we've seen in the pandemic now coming out of it. I mean, a lot of people point to low interest rates, record low interest rates, really fueling the ability for people to get out there and afford homes maybe they never could have before. As we expect rates to maybe rise here in the next year or so, I mean, how do you see that impacting maybe the marginal buyers and what it could do to home prices? Are you expecting a big change there, or maybe not so much?
Right. So, you know, mortgage rates have helped a lot. In January of this year, we hit an all-time low of mortgage rates. I think it was 2.65. That rate started increasing again, but then in a recent month or two, it started coming down again to where we are now expecting the rates to remain below 3% through the end of this year. Like you said, that is an important driver for people who have a budget constraints, and they can't just go out and buy whatever they, you know, in particular locations maybe that they would like to buy. So they have to seek out further from these expensive areas. But because of this, because of home prices rising at 17%, which is what our index last showed, and continued expectations of home prices going at double-digit rates, that we will be losing a lot of people that cannot afford anymore. And hence, when we look at our home price index next year, it's going to slow down significantly to very low single-digit rates in most areas.
What percentage of potential home buyers would you say have actually been priced out of the market? We've been hearing on the other side, in the cities at least, about rental prices really pushing higher. I wonder if there's an argument to be made that those who couldn't necessarily afford a home in the suburbs are saying, well, if I can't buy a home there, I'm going to move back to the city and rent.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, well, one indicator it played out very, it illustrated itself very well is we track single family rentals, and the index has been growing. It actually in the last reading, it was five times at the rate that it was before the pandemic. So just to put it in context, maybe it was growing at 2% and now it's growing at 10% on a year-over-year basis. So people are opting for rentals if they can't find a home to purchase. And, you know, as you mentioned, in large urban areas and in city centers, people are coming back in. And so a lot of the indicators are showing that rental prices are increasing again, where they were actually declining until earlier this year.
Well, the legal cannabis market continues to climb here in the U.S., and the largest cannabis company in the U.S. is continuing to reap those rewards. Massachusetts-based Curaleaf reported second quarter revenue of $312 million. That was up 20% from the first quarter, more than 160% year over year. That was ahead of what analysts were expecting at $307 million. The company also reported an adjusted net loss of $7.2 million, while gross margins improved 669 basis points year over year to hit nearly 50% in the quarter. The stock, as you can see there, reacting to some of those results we got earlier in the week. But for more on that, happy to bring back in the executive chair of Curaleaf, Boris Jordan, joins us once again. Boris, good to see you. Looked like strong demand out there for the quarter, but on the call looking ahead, you mentioned maybe some softness in the summer months as people got back to normal life, traveling. How's demand maybe changing right now in the cannabis space?
I think this is a short-term transitory thing that we've seen a bit of weakness across the country with mainly, you have to understand, a bulk of the business is still medical. States require medical cards. It's very highly regulated. So when you move from state to state, you can't use your medical card in another state. So therefore, people that are traveling and are on holidays can't, you know, go into the stores and buy their cannabis, particularly if they're traveling out of state. So we've definitely seen a bit of that. We've seen, you know, people just getting out of their home, going on vacation, spending money on airfare, hotels and restaurants and things like that. So, you know, there's been a bit of competition for share of wallet. But even with that dynamic where we saw, you know, small 1% to 2% decreases in spend, we still grew 20% quarter on quarter. We expect to continue to grow over 100% year on year in our business this year. So we feel very, very good about the development of the market. I mean, Americans at the end of the day just want more cannabis, and that's what we're seeing across the board in the country.
And more Americans getting access to that too. There's about $9 billion in cannabis coming online shortly in the tri-state area. You got New York, New Jersey trying to get their program set up. You mentioned maybe some inflationary or even macro supply issues in getting facilities built out as competition heats up. How's that impacting the timeline Curaleaf has to get those states set up the way you want to?
So Curaleaf, interestingly enough, is a company that got launched on the East Coast. So we have very strong positioning on the East Coast of the United States. We're the leader, absolute leader in New York, absolute leader in New Jersey. We share the leadership position in Connecticut. You know, share the leadership position, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Florida. So, you know, three of those states are definitely going. So New Jersey is going to go rec in November, according to the governor himself. Connecticut in second quarter of next year. And New York, you never know. We thought it was going to be early 23, first quarter 23, but that may change now with the power shift in Albany. You know, the Governor Cuomo was less enthusiastic about cannabis. The incoming lieutenant governor, from our understanding, is more understanding and wants to get the program up and going. And so we might get some acceleration on New York program. But you're right, it's about $8, $9 billion of potential market. We're fully built out and on the East Coast and ready to supply that market.
Yeah, when you think about, I guess, where the U.S. is, obviously, we've been hearing more and more about that push among progressive Democrats to kind of get that legalization, full legalization bill kind of across the finish line, you know, instituting that at a federal level. When we talk about the other alternatives there, safe banking, we had Senator Cory Booker on the show not too long ago talking about maybe walking back and supporting that as well. I mean, when you look at that, your timeline here, as it drags on, how do you maybe start shifting maybe away from investing in the U.S. to, you know, Europe versus kind of how that dynamic's playing out right now? How do you see it?
I mean, the U.S. market is definitely the place still for growth. It's the most, you know, developed market. It's the most, has the most growth capability. Obviously, if we get safe banking, which I think we will by April of next year, I think they're first going to vote at the end in the fourth quarter, probably on a more comprehensive bill. I don't think that bill will get through, although we'll try to get it through with interstate commerce and rescheduling. I just don't think Republicans are ready for that yet. I do think, though, that we've got the votes in the Republican Party, 60 votes to get safe banking through. And let's be honest, for social equity, which is the big issue for progressives and for Democrats, without safe banking, you're not going to get social equity, right? If people can't open up bank accounts, can't borrow at reasonable rates, and workers can't open up bank accounts or get credit cards, you're never going to be able to get that business up and going. And so we really need safe banking. It's very, very important for the sector, and it's the best thing we can get to get social equity programs up and going. So the U.S. is our primary focus, but I have to think long term, and I can't think over the next 2-3 years. I got to think over the next 5 to 10 years. And there's no question the European market is twice the size of the U.S. It has a massive culture of cannabis use. And we wanted to make sure we put our foot on the ground in Europe and started to build the operations. So as we get into 23, 24 and 25, the European operations will start to seriously contribute to both the revenue and the bottom line of Curaleaf. But for the for this year and for next year, it's really a building exercise, very similar to what we were doing, you know, 4 or 5 years ago in the U.S. But it's a huge market. It's, you know, Israel's growing, Germany's growing, the U.K. is growing 45% month on month right now in the medical program. So we're, you know, Holland is moving towards adult use. So we're very excited about the acquisition we made in Europe.
Yeah, when you talk about if the timeline there is Q1 next year for safe banking maybe coming through, I mean, how do you see that being an impact to the financials? Because, you know, you guys are the larger player there. I don't imagine you guys have ever struggled to kind of raise money. But when it comes to the impact on the business. How do you see that maybe changing things for Curaleaf in 2022?
It will change it dramatically. I mean, you know, we don't have standard working capital facilities to finance inventory and stuff like that, right? It's just too expensive today to do that. So we are really looking forward to it. We think the cost of capital will drop by 50% at a minimum. So if the average cost of capital in the market today, well, a year, 6 months ago was about 12.5%. Right now it's probably getting down for the better operators around 9-10%. Curaleaf's going to be refinancing our $350 million of debt in January. We think we can get 8-9%. Financing for that, maybe even better. But safe banking will bring that down. And it'll also diversify the kind of financing we can get, short-term working capital, long-term debt, bonds, equity markets. Obviously, there'll be a re-rating of equity prices so we could raise money on the equity markets as well. It will bring down the cost of capital by 50%. There's no question about it. It's a very positive development for the sector.
That's pretty important. I would agree when we talk about kind of safe banking versus the larger social justice push that progressive Democrats are pushing for. Obviously, it seems like one does have the votes right now, the other one, the lofty goal. But companies like yours also kind of playing a role in the social justice push. You guys recently launched a brand partnership to bring attention to some of the criminal injustices here in the past. We also mentioned on the earnings call a diversity push at the board level. So what do those efforts look like for Curaleaf?
I mean, Curaleaf is the leader in social equity and social justice issues. And I think that's one of the things people in Washington need to realize is that we've embraced it in a big way, and we can help many of these companies. We can help them open up stores. We can provide them lines with product so they can, you know, finance them on a working capital basis. There's a tremendous amount of things we could do to further the industry. And it's in our interest to do that because the more players are on the market, the more people we can sell products to. So we're really looking forward to that. We've done partnerships on branding as we did with Be Noble. We've done numerous, I think we have 63 partnerships with minority groups right now around the country. We have a whole division of Curaleaf that's just focused on that. That's their sole job, is to bring cannabis to a lot of the communities that were hurt and help those communities in building businesses in these areas. And so we have multiple entrepreneurs that we're working with. We have a tremendous amount of programs internally in order to be able to do that. We've got one of the leaders on that issue, Khadija Tribble, that's spearheading that for us. And she's a spokesman for the industry in that area. So, you know, if you're going to be the biggest company, you got to lead as the biggest company. We're really trying to lead in this area. And I'm telling every politician, Booker, Schumer, I've talked to everybody. I'm saying, guys, banking, safe banking will really charge up the social justice issues in the minority communities. It will really help tremendously in getting these people to open up businesses, open stores, and to function in the cannabis world. Doing nothing does nothing. That's the point.
Yeah, access to capital, obviously an issue regardless. If you can't access it, doesn't really matter if you're in the minority camp or not, something that's impacting the sector writ large. Boris Jordan, appreciate you coming on here as always. Thanks again for the time. Executive Chairman, Curaleaf, thanks again.
It's gone. There's several times in the last week I've wished I could just go home. And then I remember, you can't go home. There's nothing to go back to. Even if the house survived, like pretty much the rest of town is gone. There's no power. There's no water. Everything's gone.
You're listening to Jack Romero there, one of the residents displaced by the Dixie Fire in Northern California. It has now scorched nearly 500,000 acres and destroyed roughly 900 structures. California's second largest wildfire in history. Just the latest in a long list of climate-related disasters we have seen so far this year. And a UN report released this week points to human activity as the key factor driving global warming. The study from the UN's Panel on Climate Change saying temperatures will continue to rise over the next 30 years, even if countries take immediate action to curb greenhouse gas emissions. For much more on that, let's bring in one of the lead authors of that landmark report. We've got Kim Cobb, Georgia Tech Professor, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, and Director of the Global Change Program. And Kim, it's great to talk to you today. One of the things that struck me about this report is this word unequivocal, talking about human activity unequivocally driving global warming. And it strikes me that in 2021, we're still talking about that. It's been 8 years since that initial report, or What has changed since then that points to that word and the clarity, the certainty that says this is exactly why we are here today?
Well, thanks for having me. And first, I really want to give my best wishes to all of those who are so incredibly impacted by this spate of wildfires and horrific weather, not just across California, but also in Greece and Turkey. And this new report brings new clarity to humans' role in the ongoing warming that we're experiencing, calling it unequivocal. That's due to longer records, better models, and frankly, the signals leaping out of the background noise. But actually, human influence on climate is nothing new. We've known about this for several decades. What is new about this report is the very strong physical links that we can draw across multiple lines of evidence, tying climate and weather extremes, such as heat waves on land and in the oceans, extreme rainfall droughts, and yes, fire-prone weather to ongoing warming. That's the bad news from the report, but there is some good news baked in there as well.
So let's talk about the bad news first, because it does highlight the fact that the world has warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the 19th century. Conditions, according to the report, will continue to worsen for at least another 30 years. And we're talking about this in a year where we have seen record flooding in countries like China and India. We saw the heat dome out in the Northwest earlier this year. How much worse is it going to get if we're talking about the next 3 decades?
Well, one thing the report makes very clear is that this package of climate and weather extremes will get worse with each additional increment of warming that we let slip through our fingers. That's really the bad news. The report also helps us understand that the trajectory to 2050 will be warming, but that how hot it gets is still up to us. Even in that very near-term future, we are looking at either an additional half a degree of Celsius to keep warming to 1.5, the most ambitious goals outlined in the Paris Agreement, or let it slip to 2 degrees Celsius or warmer. Each of that additional increment associated with the worsening of these climate impacts and, of course, baking in consequences for later this century as well.
So let's talk about what can be done at this point. As we speak, you've got Congress debating 2 separate bills here that do include significant climate provisions, including money for EV charging stations, potentially a clean energy standard as well. When you look at what's being debated by lawmakers, how aggressive are those actions and how far are they go? Will they likely go in trying to reverse global warming?
Well, the most ambitious goals that are outlined by the Biden administration are consistent with achieving net zero emissions of greenhouse gases by 2050. That is a critical benchmark outlined in this new report, consistent with the most ambitious trajectory of reducing warming as much as possible to mid-century and reserving the right to cool into the latter half of this century. So yes, deep investments do need to be made. A bold, aggressive action is absolutely necessary, but the benefits are also tangible, not just for the climate system, but of course, so many of these changes that we're talking about in terms of shifting away from fossil fuels have benefits to our economy, not the least of which is improved public health from air pollution and environmental deterioration. So we have to keep these things in mind as we take in the new risks that this report has dropped in our lap, policymakers across the country having to look closely at what series of impacts they will be facing now and how they weigh risk management going forward, important choices.
On the private side, we've increasingly seen a lot of companies, right, take up the mantle on climate change and the absence of leadership on a federal level. What role do you think businesses can play in combating climate change?
Oh, I think they have a huge role to play. I mean, we need to be looking at aggressive action across every level of society. Federal action is absolutely required, but we need to have action at every institutional level to help us move this forward. And not the least because some of the most important advances that may yet come in helping us to accelerate action will come from public-private partnerships, as well as companies that are helping their communities, their employees, their workforce, workers and their stakeholders and shareholders understand what the risks are that we face with ongoing climate change and articulate why it's important to their bottom line that we reduce the coming risks of climate change as well. So all of these reasons, critically important motivators, I hope, for the private sector to continue to up the ante and raise their ambitions to be a part of this transition and make it as fast as possible.
And finally, Kim, we're talking about all of this just a few months out from COP26, of course, the big UN climate meeting over in Glasgow in November. What would you consider a successful outcome there? We've talked so much about climate change, and yet when you think about the major emitters, whether it's the US, China, or India, there's still a lot of questions about how committed these countries are to taking aggressive action.
Well, certainly, I hope that this report lands into that conversation and really provides a foundation for policymakers who are coming together during those critical talks to really weigh the risks and the benefits of a near-term reduction in greenhouse gases, the kind of deep, sustained reductions that will keep us on the path to limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by mid-century and recoup those near-term tangible benefits in risk management. The other thing I hope we see is a commitment to help developing nations who are by the brunt of climate damages from some of those worst possible outcomes. And so I know that's an important conversation that will be occurring later this year as well.
Kim Cobb, it's great to talk to you today. One of the lead authors of that UN climate report. She's also a professor at Georgia Tech. Appreciate you joining us.
Shauna, nothing says loving like a glass of wine, some candlelight at dusk, and a big old plate of infrastructure. I say that jokingly, but it's important because we are going to talk infrastructure with a member of the House of Representatives from Massachusetts. We invite into the stream Representative Ayanna Pressley, along with our education reporter, R.T. Swaminathan, because we also want to talk about what's going on with student debt payments and moratoriums. We're going to get to all of that. But Representative, thank you for joining us in the stream. And have to ask you, this $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal now in the House, there are Democrats who are saying not so fast. Is this thing going to pass?
I think what's important and what progressives and certainly Democratic leadership and even President Biden have been holding the line on, and I expect us to stay the course, is that if we're going to pass, that these bills must be passed in tandem. A more narrow bipartisan infrastructure bill and then a broader reconciliation bill that meets the moment and then makes those investments in human infrastructure. Infrastructure is more than capital. It's more than highways, roads, and bridges. Climate justice is infrastructure. Housing is infrastructure. The care economy is infrastructure. Childcare is infrastructure. And so we need to pass a broad reconciliation bill, and those bills should be moved in tandem. And I think it's very important in order for us to restore and or to maintain the trust of the American people that we keep our word on that and that we pass bold investments that meet the moment and most importantly, meet the needs of the people. The greatest tool of persuasion is impact. And so we have to keep our word and we have to deliver for the American people.
Representative, if they are passed in tandem, if we do see the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package and this $3.5 trillion budget framework that we got passed this morning in the Senate, does it go far enough in your view?
You know, there's nothing in front of me as of right now. And so I'm just a firm believer in that, you know, I continue to push for legislation and investments that will ensure that we have a just, equitable, and robust recovery, that we do not return to just a recovery to a pre-COVID status quo normal. We know that was already insufficient, but that we are charting a different path forward. Every inequity and disparity and racial injustice was laid bare during this pandemic and exacerbated. And so I just continue to organize and to advocate for those broad investments that are responsive to the needs of the people. Housing is infrastructure, care is infrastructure. And of course we have to make those formidable investments so far as our climate resiliency as well.
Representative Pressley, I wanna pivot to student loans because without you know, paying all these student loans, people have been able to reallocate that money. But we got that news that the Education Department is finally extending that pause, but they're not extending it to when you wanted it to be extended to March 2022 is when you said you would be a preferred date. What do you think about this final extension that they're doing? Does it go far enough, or do you think that we need to pair this with something else?
Yeah, I think it's both and. This is a nearly $2 trillion crisis. It is affecting people from every walk of life. I just came from visiting a senior community in my district of 100 elders. And this was one of the first issues that they asked me about. In fact, the fastest growing constituency of student borrowers are 50 plus. I have constituents in my district that are 76 years old, still paying on student loans. This is an economic justice issue. It is a racial justice issue. Another report came out saying that this has student debt disproportionately falls on the shoulders of Black and brown borrowers. And it has created the racial wealth gap. Higher education was supposed to close the racial wealth gap, but that's not true for Black Americans. 85% of Black students feel they have no choice but to borrow, and then they are five times more likely to default than their white counterparts. So this is a tool for our recovery. It's a way to jumpstart the economy. It is an economic justice issue. It is a racial justice issue. It is a nearly $2 trillion crisis. We organized and fought to extend the pause on student loan payments, myself, Senator Warren, and Leader Schumer. And now we have to go farther, and that is to cancel student debt up to $50,000 with the same authority that President Biden used to extend the pause on payments to cancel student debt by executive action with the stroke of a pen and mitigate this hurt. People are paying student loan bills monthly that are the equivalent of mortgage payments.
Representative Presley, you mentioned something that I want to bring up again, that higher education was seen as a ladder up into more money, better situation for themselves. But again and again, we've seen so much research saying Black student borrowers are actually being weighed down, wealth building is taking an impact. So how do you explain this to someone considering college for the very first time?
That's right. It is a racial justice issue. And because of draconian discriminatory policies like redlining, Black families did not have the same opportunity to build generational wealth, which is why this burden has fallen disproportionately on Black and brown student borrowers. So again, it is a racial justice issue, and we can do something about it. It's a nearly $2 trillion crisis, and we need to alleviate this hardship for the American people and cancel student debt by executive action. The president does have the authority. Congress gave him that authority through the Higher Education Act. And so the same authority that was used to extend the pause on payments, that same authority can be used to cancel student debt at $50,000 by executive action, and we should do it. When it comes to student debt, it is not or, it is both and. We need to do whatever we can in the here and now and beyond to eliminate this hardship for the American people.
Representative, sometimes good intentions have unexpected consequences. The Washington Post this morning had an interesting article about the eviction moratorium and how it's impacting individual mom and pop landlords, actually, as they describe them, people of color, because then I'm not talking about the people who might be evicted, but the landlords who are unable now to collect rent. And I know that the Congress has allocated billions of dollars to help all of these people, the renters as well as the landlords, but it's not working just as it was intended. What can be done to make sure that these people on both sides are not impacted any further in a negative way?
Sure. Well, what I found is that there was a lot of misinformation about who could access RAFT. And again, we did appropriate those formidable investments. And we just need to get those funds out. And again, this is about alleviating the hardship. The pandemic may have disproportionately hit some communities harder than others, but everyone has felt the hurt of this public health crisis, this pandemic-induced recession, and we must leave no one behind. And so that includes renters and also small landlords. I serve in the Financial Services Committee, and I want to thank Chairwoman Waters for her leadership. I think it's really critical that we bring her bill to the floor to extend this eviction moratorium and to continue to address these issues writ large. But we need states and municipalities to get these funds out. And again, there's been a lot of misinformation about who can access these funds. The funds have been appropriated. They are there to both mitigate the hardship for renters as well as small landlords. So please do take advantage of those resources.
Representative Ayanna Pressley, representing in Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us. R.T. Swaminathan, as always,